Portis against Chicago. Mr. Henri.
Please the court. The district court held that taking more than 2 hours to release arrestees on I bonds after they have been determined eligible for release violates the Fourth Amendment as a matter of law. The court thereby created a new per se rule of unreasonableness under which the court is liable to each of the thousands of class members without regard to any circumstances that might reasonably justify not releasing them sooner. The per se rule created by the district court is inconsistent with Fourth Amendment case law. Indeed, the district court's per se rule conflicts with County of Riverside v. McLaughlin in several respects. McLaughlin held that unless warrantless arrestees are detained longer than 48 hours without a probable cause determination by a judge or magistrate, the government is immune from systemic challenges under the Fourth Amendment. In this case, there is no evidence or even an allegation that any class member was detained as long as 48 hours. Thus, under McLaughlin, the city is immune from the systemic challenge presented by plaintiff's class action. And the district court erred both by allowing the case to proceed as a class action and beyond that by ruling that under the per se rule fashioned by the court, the city is liable to every class member of the class as a matter of law. McLaughlin also made clear that any arrestee can proceed on an individual claim, but held that on such a claim, an arrestee who was detained less than 48 hours without a probable cause hearing bears the burden of proving that his release was delayed unjustifiably. Under that holding, the district court's per se rule of liability to every arrestee held longer than 2 hours after being determined eligible for release on an I bond is unsupportable. The district court did not even consider whether the delays in releasing plaintiffs might be justified. Its ruling instead reflects its view that detaining arrestees longer than 2 hours after they are determined eligible for release on an I bond is inherently unreasonable and cannot be justified by any circumstances conceivable. But that is patently incorrect. Both sides agree that after an arrestee is determined eligible for release on an I bond, the I bond must be prepared, after which the arrestee can be released only if he assents to the conditions set forth in the I bond. Completing either of those steps could be delayed justifiably. Plaintiffs emphasize that it takes only a few minutes to prepare an I bond. But this ignores that preparation of an I bond cannot begin until the official assigned that duty, the desk sergeant, is available. And preparing I bonds is not the only responsibility desk sergeants have. Indeed, they have several responsibilities just in connection with other steps in the processing of arrestees, such as reviewing all the documentation generated by arresting officers and preparing all charges. Thus, issuance of an I bond for a given arrestee could of necessity be reasonably delayed while the desk sergeant processes other arrestees or discharges other pressing police business assigned to him.
Have any individual actions ever been filed prior to this?
Arrestees on I bond?
These are people who are arrested for non-jailable offenses.
Correct.
Jaywalking.
Correct.
Maybe a jaywalking ticket on Michigan Avenue or something, and he can be taken into custody, and might be 14 hours that you're there before you're released. Has anybody ever prevailed against the city or brought a case against the city on an individual basis for being unreasonably detained in one of these situations?
I'm unaware of any case that's ever been brought by a person released on I bond claiming that his detention was unreasonably long. Of course, the charges for which a person could be arrested on an I bond that would allow him to be released on an I bond do range from everything like jaywalking all the way to disturbing the peace, some reasonably significant kinds of charges. But even after an I bond is prepared for an arrestee, he cannot be released until he assents to the conditions it sets forth, conditions that include, among other things, that he appear in court to answer the charge, that he not leave the state without permission of the court, and that he promptly report changes of address to the court. But obtaining the arrestee's assent to those conditions may of necessity also be reasonably delayed if he is asleep, ill, or under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And plaintiffs concede in their brief that fully 10% of arrestees are visibly under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and that some arrestees sleep in the lockup. Thus, many arrestees are undoubtedly unable to assent to the conditions of the I bond once it is prepared. Indeed, the record establishes that one of the named plaintiffs, Portis, has been arrested multiple times, and Portis himself testified that ordinarily, when he was not released before the beginning of his usual sleep time, he slept in the station's lockup. Consequently, while the three named plaintiffs may proceed on their individual claims, the city cannot be liable to them by application of the two-hour per se rule. Rather, for any of the named plaintiffs to prevail, he would have to prove that the delay in releasing him was unjustified, such as because it reflected delay for delay's sake or ill will. But the delay in releasing him was fully justified where it is attributable to other more pressing business at the police station or to the plaintiff's inability, because he was ill, asleep, or under the influence of drugs or alcohol, to assent to the conditions of the I bond and accept the return of his belongings.
Do you know why Lance was delayed? It was 14 hours for him before he was released. What were the reasons, if you know? I don't
in the, we set those out in the statement of facts in our brief, or at least we set out what the plaintiffs have admitted to. The record includes our response, our statement of additional material facts, in which we set out all the things that happened on the day that operated that could have contributed to the delay. Plaintiffs have admitted some of them. There were several arrestees, like six or seven other arrestees that had to be processed that day, and some arrestees had to be taken to court for probable cause hearings under Durstein, arrestees who obviously were not eligible for release.
Well, if there's a probable cause hearing, then that this is not
right.
The kind of case that would address that.
No, but officials at the station would be tied up processing those arrestees. So our arrestee, or the arrestees that are members of this class, would have to wait in line behind the processing of those arrestees. If the if police personnel were tied up getting them ready to go to court or doing any of the other myriad things that have to be done to process arrestees, and those arrestees were ahead of the arrestees in this class, then the arrestees in this class would naturally have to wait. Plaintiffs adduce no evidence showing that the detention of even one arrestee was unjustified in light of the applicable factors, the press of other police business at the station, or the inability of the arrestee because he was asleep, ill, or under the influence of drugs or alcohol to assent to the conditions of the I bond. In effect, the district court's per se rule required the equivalent of a supermarket express checkout line for arrestees eligible under state law for release on I bonds. But as the case law plainly establishes, the Fourth Amendment mandates no such preferential treatment. If there are no more questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Counselor. Ms. Eberle.
May it please the Court. This case is about the city's failure to complete within 2 hours a task that undisputedly takes several minutes. The completion of this simple, non-discretionary task, which arises after all the steps incident to arrest are completed and the class member is eligible for release on an I bond, would allow the class members to simply leave the station. But instead
I'm not sure it's as simple as you describe it.
Well, Your Honor, based on the court's factual finding, which is not disputed on this appeal, the city petitioned for this interlocutory appeal on the undisputed facts. And the undisputed facts are, as found by the court, once the watch commander makes the determination that they're eligible for release and an IBON number is assigned, there is nothing or next to nothing left to do but release
what
them.
What if you're drunk and sleeping it off?
Well, Your Honor, our class is narrowly defined.
And it excludes drunks, does it?
No, it does not, Your Honor. It excludes drunks, in fact.
So you need to answer Judge Evans's question.
Yes, it is defined by people who are eligible for release without fingerprinting. And these are the procedures that they track, the procedures followed by the City of Chicago's for processing people to be eligible release on an I-bond. So these people are, the record establishes that they had to have cooperated, answered questions, and to the satisfaction of the watch commander, that this person is properly identified. Now, if they're not properly identified and the watch commander is not...
Counsel, I at least would appreciate it if you would answer Judge Evans's question.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. It does not include drunks because drunks would be excluded because they would not be able to cooperate to establish their identity.
Why? You can be drunk but have perfectly good identification in your pocket. You pull out your driver's license or your passport. You establish your identity.
Well, according to the record, Your Honor, that if they don't answer, specifically in the record, is if they don't answer questions. It's not just your ID.
You can answer questions when you're drunk.
Well, Your Honor.
Are you a drinking person yourself?
Not much.
No. I've encountered perfectly coherent drunks over the years.
Well, Your Honor, that may be true. But
I even hang around with them a lot. But I mean...
maybe they are drunk,
well,
but
you would be in a better position if the class definition were limited to people who could voluntarily sign the I-bond. But the set of people who are drunk or mentally incompetent or high on drugs can't give a voluntary consent to the I-bond within 2 hours or perhaps at all. But it looks like the class has got them in it.
Well, Your Honor, like I said, the record, this was litigated on the record over 5 years. And the ability, the capacity to assent to the I-bonds was not actually even raised below. So there is no evidence in the record that a certain ability is required. There is no evidence
that is part of the problem. The district court established a rule that would apply completely without regard to reasons or evidence or reasonableness. It was just 2 hours per se. But the Fourth Amendment says that you have to behave reasonably. I can easily see that waiting 2 hours can be unreasonable in an awful lot of cases. But the proposition that waiting 2 hours is always unreasonable, and that's what the district court held, no matter what's going on in the station and no matter what is the case with the arrestee, certainly doesn't sound like the Fourth Amendment's tort standard. It sounds like a rule issued by the Federal Arrest Regulatory Commission.
Well, Your Honor, the city had 5 years to give a justification to convince the district court why this very limited class, and I can address further the drunkenness, the assenting issue. But these are people who are brought through a two-hour process. They are kept in a holding area for these 2 hours while the arresting officer processes the paperwork, takes it to the desk sergeant, takes it to the watch commander. The watch commander makes his determinations. There, the watch commander determines that this person is eligible for release on an I-bond. So the watch commander has made that determination. And this is a very narrow class of those people that the watch commander has approved eligible for release.
So they make that determination, but then something happens. A lot of arrestees are brought in. And
right,
almost a million people arrested in Chicago in this 4-year period. How do you account for that with a rule that says 2 hours and 1 minute and you violate the Constitution.
Right, Your Honor. Well, what happens after the watch commander makes this determination? The court found, and then an IBAN number, or I'm sorry, a CB number, a unique identifying number, is assigned to that arrest. Now we're at the fork in the road. These people are eligible for release. That's what was extensively litigated below, whether or not these people were eligible for release. Now that it's been established that these people are eligible for release, there's nothing left but the simple ministerial task.
They're just released.
Exactly. Exactly, Your Honor.
Isn't that simple?
Even if they can't make a voluntary decision to sign the IBAN because they're too drunk.
Well.
Or because they've gone into diabetic shock.
Well, then they would be taken to the hospital, Your Honor.
District court's order. Under the district court's order, they must be released within 2 hours.
Well, okay, between the determination that these people are eligible for release, the watch commander is satisfied that they are eligible for release, and signing the IBAN, that's a matter of minutes. Now, they may go into shock between there, but
the district court's order, I take it, they have to be just thrown out of the station. It would be a violation of the Constitution under the district court's order to take them to the hospital because that wouldn't be release.
Well, if between when they answer the questions and the court determines, this is a matter of minutes.
It won't be a matter of minutes. That's your whole point. The determination is made. At this point, the district court says they have 2 hours to release the person. Right? 90 minutes later, the person goes into diabetic shock.
I understand your concern, but...
The district court's order, as I understand it, says that as a matter of law, the only thing the police can do is, sometime within the next 30 minutes, turn this person out in a state of shock on the street.
Well...
It is forbidden to take him to a hospital.
No, Your Honor. And
most police don't want to be held in contempt of court, I assume.
Well, the alternative, let me just mention the alternative first. What they do in the alternative is, in order to complete this 2 minutes worth of work, is lock them up.
Is that alternative set up clearly in the order of the court?
Your Honor, the court did not want to micromanage what the court...
Well, they did.
Your Honor, he didn't want to micromanage. He said, you have 2 minutes worth of steps. Class member is here. The arresting officer is here. Do that 2 minutes, and he's out.
If no one else is doing anything.
But the arrest... Well, Your Honor, we'll get to that. I can address that now.
That'd be a time to do.
I'm sorry?
I'd address it now.
Okay, that's what I will address. The record is clear that any desk officer can fill out the IBAN and have it signed by the class member. Mm-hmm. On appeal, they're asserting that only the desk sergeant can. However, in their statement of facts below, they said the desk officer or the desk sergeant reviews the paperwork in the processing. But when it comes to signing the IBAN, they list any desk officer can do it. There's not a scrap of evidence that one of the many desk officers would not be available to do it. There's no evidence that this cannot be done promptly.
So why do you think McLaughlin said that state and local governments have 48 hours to take somebody before a magistrate?
Because there are a lot of steps. Once the steps incident to arrest are completed, they have to arrange for the magistrate, a time for the magistrate and the arresting officer to be both available. They have to arrange for transportation.
Almost every state and local government, like the federal government, has magistrates who are available, if not 24 hours a day, at least on very short notice. Under McLaughlin, somebody who is arrested on Monday morning can be presented to a magistrate on Wednesday morning, even though two business days have gone by. Why do you think the Supreme Court would allow that?
Well, they won't allow it, Your Honor, if they can establish there was delay for delay's sake. If within the 48 hours there is delay for delay's sake.
No district court can say, in this district we have magistrates available around the clock, therefore I am modifying McLaughlin from 48 hours to 12.
That's true, Your Honor.
Right?
Right.
So why, even in places where a magistrate is available all the time, is the Supreme Court allowing 48 hours?
Well, because they also don't want to micromanage what happens in the police station. And there's issues of transportation. There may be one bus a day. There may be two buses a day. There's a lot to take into account.
No, it sounds like you're saying really what should be happening is that a district judge should hold a hearing and decide that in Chicago there are magistrates available all the time, the police stations have plenty of people available, the courts are nearby, and therefore there shouldn't be 48 hours. There should be 12, and a district judge can say that. I mean, that's pretty much in the spirit of what happened here. But I'm trying to figure out why McLaughlin is doing things differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard that, you see my problem, it's very hard for me to understand the style of order that the district court has entered and reconcile that with the way the Supreme Court approached a similar subject in McLaughlin.
Well, I think what the district court recognized is this decision to, instead of simply release the class member, to lock him up and perform steps that the court found were redundant for these class members. Redundant and unnecessary. It actually burdens the police personnel to go through all of these steps. They have to screen them, inventory their clothing. These are steps that are make work. What the court decided was this in itself constituted delay for delay's sake. So this was a holding that putting them through this.
See my problem. I think district judge could say the very same thing about taking somebody before a magistrate for the first time, at least in a big city like Chicago. And yet McLaughlin prohibits that. McLaughlin says if you're taken there within 48 hours, you have the burden to show that that was too long. You may be able to do it. Right? It may be that in Chicago, anybody who waits 12 hours to go to the court will be able to show that that was unreasonably long. But the court says just because a judge believes that, the judge can't enter a general order setting 12 hours as the rule. And I'm trying to figure out why this is any different, why it should be governed by different principles.
Well, I think if a district court identifies a procedure that results in 16 extra hours that is completely unnecessary, that he can identify that procedure and say, you can't perform that procedure, this make work, this waste of taxpayers' money. Instead, you have to simply release the person. And that he can identify this procedure as delay for delay's sake. Now, if you get rid of that procedure and there's still other impediments, then that's a different case. But what our district court did was identified a specific procedure that's extremely well-defined, where it's a matter of minutes, all of these different exigencies are not going to rise within this few minutes. The point is to avoid the press of other police business. So he identified this very identifiable time period as delay for delay's sake. And it says, you can't do that. Taking more than 2 hours for this is delay for delay's sake. And Your Honor, this case is more akin to the Seventh Circuit's holding in Graminos v. Jewell and Moore v. Marketplace Restaurant, where
both of which preceded McLaughlin.
Well, there's also Chortek, which came after McLaughlin, that confirmed that if the police take more than 4 hours to do the administrative steps incident to arrest, then the police have to explain why it takes that long. So that is a subcategory of McLaughlin.
You don't get my point. Graminos didn't survive McLaughlin.
Well,
right? The Supreme Court said the burden shifts at 48 hours, not at 4 hours or some other number. Mr. Graminos might in the future be able to bear the burden of showing that more than 4 hour delay is unreasonableness, but the federal court can't shift the burden earlier than 48 hours. That's the holding of McLaughlin.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that's when a probable cause hearing is contemplated. In Chortek, the city of Milwaukee, the Seventh Circuit said they reaffirmed Moore and Graminos. They said more than 4 hours, you have to justify what is being done in those 4 hours. And Arlotta v. Bradley Center also said the same thing, that there is an identifiable period, these 4 hours, when you're not going to be taken before a probable cause hearing, because those other problems don't exist, transportation and magistrate. So there's a four-hour period after which the burden shifts. Okay. And I submit that our class is so well-defined that these are people who are eligible for release, that nothing can interfere in this 2 minutes of getting the class members out the door. There was also an issue of the court did say that in the damages phase, that if there were individual circumstances that the city can establish why a person would not be able to be released immediately, that can be raised at the damages phase. So if the city can establish that someone was drunk, could answer questions but was drunk, or went into a diabetic shock, that person could be excluded at the damages phase. Now, there's also an issue of whether or not we're relying on state law. And state law does not come into play here. The only way state law comes into play is through Gerstein's assertion that you can only hold people who are arrested on probable without a warrant before probable cause hearing. You can only hold them for a brief period to perform the administrative steps incident to release. So our position is that Chortek incorporated Gerstein, and the brief period of detention can only be defined by the state law that defines what are these administrative incidents to arrest that justify the prolonged detention once they're eligible for release. Another difference is in the probable cause hearing situation of Riverside, those people are not eligible for release. In this circumstance, people are eligible for release, and therefore there is no legitimate reason to hold them longer. Another glossing over the record that I'd like to address is that the police officers have to guard these people throughout the entire process, and that's simply not true. These people are brought in, and they're put in a secured holding area. So their justification of putting them into lockup so that the police officer can leave the street, go back to the street, is not accurate. The court directly held they're put in a secured area. So this case boils down to, is there a reason to justify putting class members into lockup, which results in 2 to 16 hours of additional detention, when all they really had to do was several minutes of non-discretional work? And as I said, this case was brought on undisputed facts, and the court held that it was undisputed that there was nothing or next to nothing left to do after they were determined eligible for release. And as I said, if there are some circumstances the court that the city can establish, those can be dealt with on the damages phase. If you have
very much, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Henrique?
Just a brief point. Counsel.
You're not going to talk anybody out of anything, are you?
I hope not. I just wanted to straighten one thing out. Counsel stated that class members might be excluded in their individual trials on the damages phase by showing that if the city were able to show that it couldn't be liable to them because the person were intoxicated, for example. There's absolutely nothing in the district court summary judgment, order granting summary judgment in this case, saying that. And indeed, it would be, it's flatly inconsistent with the district court's per se rule saying that the city is liable to every single class member without regard to the circumstances, including their capacity to assent to the terms of the I bond. If there are no further questions, then we would ask the district, this court, to reverse the summary judgment order of the district court, and we would also ask the court to direct the district court to decertify the class, and we would ask that the case be set for further proceedings at which the three individual named plaintiffs could, if they wish, pursue separate individual claims in order to, in an effort to attempt to establish their right to relief under the McLaughlin case.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.